Corcovado Hill in Rio de Janeiro. I tried to remember its configuration, with its arms outstretched, its head and feet resting on its colossal base. I hadn't finished my intimate concentration on the details of that stupendous monument, and I already felt Dr. Janzel's hand lightly touching me. Opening my eyes, I saw, with immense surprise, on the canvas placed on the table, the outline of Corcovado, with Christ the Redeemer on top, with his arms open, exactly as I had imagined it. How can such a miracle happen? That's not exactly a drawing, I exclaimed. Yes, this isn't exactly a drawing, but a photograph of your thoughts. For several long minutes I thought about it, at the same time I was looking at that photograph, wondering how they had managed to obtain it. Ruminating on these thoughts, I turned to Dr. Janzel. I'm not satisfied with that, I had my eyes closed, can I do a new experiment? If you want to dispel doubts, let's do another experiment, imagine what you like, but keep your eyes open. Having said that, my interlocutor went to get another screen. As the helmet was already on my head, he simply turned the same device on the table, whose pointer moved to the left in the direction of the lines. Once again, the beam of light was projected onto my face and I kept my eyes on the screen, without the light impairing my vision. Trying to get away from everything local to my home in the earthly environment, I remembered the Statue of Liberty at the entrance to the port of New York, the sight of which I had seen a few days before in one of the capital's cinemas. As I mentally focused on that gigantic work, the same motifs appeared on the screen, that is the head with the crown, the raised arm holding a torch, his clothes, the pedestal and the intimately visualized panorama. Having completed the picture, Dr. Janzel returned the device to its place and the light went out. Then he took my helmet off and put it back on the table, saying, "Are you satisfied now?" I don't know what to say. As you can see, our drawing department doesn't need pens, scales, compasses, pencils, ink, pantographs, enlargement chambers, models, maps, etc. In fact, I've noticed that they don't even use photographs, as we usually do, hanging on the walls of our homes. I was very surprised. To keep photographs of certain people would be to memorialize an ephemeral being, that is the material body. In order to remember that person is not necessary to have their photograph before our eyes. We keep indelibly in our hearts their kindness and their most beneficial actions in favor of the community. So it's the immaterial part that never fades from our memory. As for the pictures of nature, we consider them to be filled with a factitious vision, because they don't capture the purity, essence or magnificence that radiates from plants, flowers and vegetation. There's nothing like feeling nature as it is, which is why we spend part of our existence in contact with it in order to invigorate our senses. Earthly man has a strict obligation to have contact with nature for at least 6 hours a week. After this conversation, I withdrew into my thoughts and went back to analyzing the details of the splendid drawing. As absorbed as I was, I didn't see Dr. Janzel sit down next to me, and it was only when his hands touched me that I realized his attitude. Turning round immediately to him, I met his compassionate gaze. "This is magnificent," I said. "If I tell my people about this planet, they won't believe me and will naturally respond with sarcastic and mocking words. They'll call me crazy." "Yes," he replied. "There are the unbelievers, the indecisive and the dubious, but the more enlightened and aware will admit the possibility that Earth humans are not the only intelligent life in the universe. Eventually, to learn that you are one of the many intelligently populated worlds, however, Dr. Janzel warned me, if your earnest words are mocked, just give a fraternal smile, have compassion on those beings, realize how little faith they have. More than ever, you will realize how callous those eager to amass fortunes from the insane exploitation of human victims, profiting from the sacrifice of their fellow human beings. I hope this makes sense what I'm about to tell you. If man uses fertile land to plant, clean water to drink, pure food, to eat, why not imitate earthly fertility, by sowing good deeds? Clean water, in clean thoughts. And pure food, in the purity of your heart. Why? In this tone, he delved into philosophical considerations, continuing on for the whole of the short time I had left in that room, and, more or less, spoke on this theme: make your heart a great hotel. Select your guests. If all your premises are filled with love, tolerance and fraternity, then, hate, rancor and dishonesty, will no longer find accommodation. Kicking a banana peel off the pavement, may be as good as giving someone a basket full of fruit. While animals attack and injure in order to obtain survival, man has it in abundance. He knows how to get it. So why kill, exhaust, exploit, if using judgment and compassion would solve everything satisfactorily for all beings? Man differs from animals in his reasoning, but he is more ferocious. His past, his history, of consecutive wars and their few periods of peace are filled with orgies and degenerating bacchanals which, once again, place them in a lower condition than the irrational. It's true that life is movement and progress, but earthly man has created, and is fueling, an irrational and one-sided progress. These are the considerable reasons for their suffering. Going back to the dawn of humanity, you will see man seeking to invent new armaments in the endless desire for world domination. There have always been those who have wanted to dominate it through the power of weapons, but this has never been achieved, nor will it ever be achieved. There's the atomic bomb. By the end of this century, earthly man will encounter the ray we call the pulver disintegrator, which, launched at a city tens of thousands of kilometers away, will pulverize it in minutes, leaving its inhabitants reduced to a pile of white dust. The aeroplanes, in full flight, when bathed in those rays, will disintegrate in a cloud of dust. The same happens to ships. The sea will be covered to a great extent with a fine layer of this dust. It won't even allow us to remember the mighty warship that used to ply it. Yet I assure you, no one will rule the world. Men will bow respectfully before those who make education compulsory. To bakers, mechanics, farmers, bricklayers, machinists, cleaners, when they represent, at the same time, so many other engineers, doctors, technicians and scientists. A country where a simple riveter is an engineer, a vegetable grower is a doctor, a radio repairman is a teacher, will successively bring peace to the world. Not by deadly means, but by the power of knowledge that will radiate to other peoples. It will be up to its members to initiate the fusion of races. At the moment, when they have reached the culminating stage of understanding, in the almost general realization of the need to refine noble sentiments, they illogically preach the need for pain in order to evolve. But if evolution were based on pain, then they would be forced to evolve, that is, without any merit. People would evolve through pain if they could, to get rid of it at any time. However, since they are forced to suffer, they do nothing more than repeat lessons learned in the past. Once this minimal progress was even with universal justice, they would then stop on the evolutionary scale of being, no longer ascending. In truth, evolution is achieved through the practice of good deeds, tolerance and kindness, in short, by our love for our fellow human beings, a quality that we have no choice but to use through our free will. That's why pain is not an evolutionary vehicle. If pain afflicts us, it's because we deserve it. It is the just reward, the honest payment for our own actions, as we have been taught. Sowing is free, but the harvest is obligatory. The problem of misunderstandings between people is a major contributor to racial issues. With their different languages, racial groups translate into harmful factionalism, generating intolerance, discord and fostering the germ of bellicosity. Concord and peace will come as a byproduct, when there is only one race and one language on your planet. It is therefore urgent to begin this transformation by recognizing each race has its own contribution to make, thus, intelligence, by the white race, physical endurance, by the black race, perspicacity and dexterity, by the yellow race, perseverance and fortitude, by the red race. It is the duty of earthly man to go back and start crossing races, in order to arrive at the desired goal, a single race. A definitive race to inherit the qualities and aptitudes of those that are currently disjointed. At this point, Dr. Jansel placed his hands paternally on my shoulders and looking at me deeply, he said, "I'm going to give you a message, listen to what I tell you. Your visit is nearly over and my people are immensely grateful for your presence. Up until now, you have been the only earthly inhabitant to visit us on this distant planet, and you have shown yourself to be very worthy of it. My fellow citizens now ask me to convey our message directly to you, addressed to all men of goodwill on your planet." The content of this message is reserved for the end of this book. I would very much appreciate your staying with us, but my dear friend needs to return. If you have any questions, please do so during the return journey. We left the drawing office and a craft was waiting for us about 40 meters away. We climbed onto it and in no time we were on the other side of that area, in the field of experimentation. From above, I could see a crowd of people waiting to see me off and to wish me a happy journey home, according to Dr. Jansel. We left that craft and, further on, the interplanetary craft stood still, as if to say, "Here I am to serve you." Calmly we went to meet it and we were greeted by the same two crew members who had come to pick me up on the banks of the Paraibuna River. I asked them how I was going to say goodbye to those people, as it would be impossible for me to greet them one by one. They told me, "Just a waving of your hands will be sufficient for them to be satisfied with your attitude." Once I had risen to the disc, I stood at the door. I raised my arms and waved in a cordial manner. In a second, under the same impulse, thousands of hands waved goodbye to me, returning my emotional goodbye. Chapter 16, Return to Earth. The craft began to ascend slowly and I could see the compassion for me in the people's eyes. They recognized that I had to return to a more rudimentary abode. Sadly, I searched the interior of the ship, reluctant to join my fellow travelers. I could see men, women and children waving up at me through the craft's natural viewfinders, but I was unable to respond to their greetings. I steeled myself aware that I was leaving a world of peace and love to face one of struggle and unrest. A tangle of thoughts enveloped me. I didn't even notice when the door closed. From that state of absorption, I was brought out of it by the pressure of Dr. Jansel's fingers, presenting me with a glass containing the same liquid I had drunk when we left Earth. With nothing left to do but savor the memory of that unknown planet and its people, I drank the precious liquid and went to sit next to Mr. Jansel to unravel, if possible, a tangle of questions. Sensing my intention, the scientist smiled and said, "You can ask. Firstly, I'd like to ask you four questions. 1. Why are houses, objects, gardens, in short, almost everything is round or circular? 2. Why are some planets so much bigger than others? 3. Why do the planets never come to an endpoint if they are always in motion? 4. Why did you say that even if our scientists manage to reach another planet, they will never return? To your first question, I'd say, we endeavor to make everything round like nature itself does in one of its most beautiful expressions. You see, from the fruits, to the immeasurable celestial masses revolving in space show us the tendency of form. To disagree with the wisdom of nature would be to go against the natural order, to violate its teachings, which is not sensible. So, we move away from anomalies to embrace the logical. To your second and third questions, I have to say, throughout the universe, the planets, with their visible and invisible particles, and light, heat, sound, substances, matter and elements, everything is spherical. The worlds travel and develop to a maximum, in size and splendor, in trillions of years, to then go decreasing, disintegrating and expelling their particles, substances, matter, elements to other developing planets, until it is reduced to an invisible and imponderable minimum that is the nucleus, the center of cosmic and evolutionary radiation, life. Wandering through endless space again, this nucleus begins to take on a visible body and develops, gravitating within its solar system, receiving substances and elements from other planets with the maximum already developed and decreasing, but this is always in motion and in a circular direction, because in the immensity of the universe there is no such thing as a straight line. In conclusion, since there is no beginning or end to a line or action, it is understood to be infinite. To your fourth question, I have to say, the calculations in terms of time, for interplanetary journeys, within your world is case, outside it is significantly different. Likewise, distances and speeds on one planet and another vary. And I'll explain this further, the human brain is tuned to the rotations of the planet on which you live. These rotations give us exact proportions in our blood circulation, they give us our cerebral balance, and reasoning. If a human being on Earth wants to travel to another planet, they can do so as long as it has the same Earth rotation speed, otherwise, when he lands on another planet, he will fall to the ground and his brain will not reason, and the blood will circulate differently, depending on the greater or lesser number of rotational speed of the planet visited. So they won't be able to survive. Dr. Janzel, earlier, reference was made to a natural light developing on the planets. Yes, when this innate light is at its peak, the planet will remain truly illuminated, because this light emanates from the center of cosmic and evolutionary irradiation. In fact, this light has already appeared on your planet, but it is still imperceptible to the naked eye. Over the centuries, as the Earth's atmosphere becomes thinner and thinner, the solar become thinner, then the sun's rays will no longer contact so much oxygen, and will no longer produce the unbearable heat of today. It will become a comfortable and invigorating heat for plants, humans and animals. But as a result, the sun's rays will no longer produce the same light, which means that the planet would become cloudy if it were not possessed its own light. By this time the planet will have lost its axial tilt, so there will only be two seasons, 3 months of autumn and 9 months of spring. Now, I'm asking you about yourself. Did you like the world where everything is rounded? Words can't express what's in my heart, nor my feelings of gratitude towards everyone, especially you. Frankly, I thought everything was marvelous and I was enchanted by everything. And, pausing for a moment, I added, I'm sorry I won't be staying longer or even continue to live here, in this atmosphere of calm and tranquility, where I have spent hours of unrivaled satisfaction in the pleasure of being received with sincere fraternity. I understand better now, why Jesus said, in my Father's house there are many mansions. My brother, don't be sad or sorry for not being able to stay with us at the moment, but one day you will have the grace to live on this planet. But how long will that take? I asked curiously. According to my calculations, you'll have to intern on, more or less 28 different planets, learning through hard work, study and also developing love for others. So we can have more than one life on each planet? I can tell you that life is one and eternal. However, we do our apprenticeships by going through the stages of life on different planets. We almost always repeat the lesson 3, 4, 8 and even 10 times, living on the same planet. How can these phases of life be explained, Doctor? Life and its phases can be defined like this. He went on to make some remarks that I'm trying to summarize. Let's take a circular cone and place the pointed end, that is the smallest part, downwards. Around its periphery at the height of which it measures, precisely 1 meter in circumference. We place a rubber band that is exactly 1 meter in circumference with its 1,000 millimeters marked off, until their tips touch. Just above, further up the cone, not overlapping, this first band, place another rubber band that is also exactly 1 meter in circumference around the cone, but we have to stretch it as the cone is wider. It's clear, therefore, that if we want to cover a larger surface, we'll have to stretch this meter of rubber, causing expansion between its millimeters. As a consequence, the millimeters of the second meter become larger. If we put a third meter band above the second meter, it's clear that this meter band needs to be pulled more, so its millimeters become larger. After the third meter band, if we place the fourth rubber meter, it will ipso facto become tighter and its millimeters will be even larger, because the surface to be covered is greater. Proceeding in this way successively, wrapping the cone with meters of rubber until we reach the largest circumference, it is obvious that the last meter will be the most taut because it has covered a larger distance. Consequently, its millimeters will be much further apart and stretched to a greater extent. At this point, he touched me with one of his hands, saying, "Pay attention to what I'm about to tell you. This cone is life and those millimeters are the phases of life, or our various stages. We start at the first meter and from millimeter to millimeter we continue until we've completed the cone's full circle. We will have traveled 1,000 millimeters, each one representing the 1,000 stages of life. At the second meter, we also start the other 1,000 stages of life, but in this case the meter is a little longer and its millimeters are bigger, the phases of the new life are longer and their length is greater. Therefore, after many, many years of practicing good, overcoming discomforts and setbacks, we will reach the third meter. Naturally, in this third meter the millimeters are longer and we will have to walk them with greater exercise of our free will, gaining in merit to take us to the fourth meter. In this way, from phase to phase, from meter to meter, evolution by evolution, we will pass through the cone that represents life. The life that God in His great magnanimity has deigned to bestow upon us." And at the end of his explanation, he said, "Behold, the evolutionary process that will give you the longed-for opportunity to live on this planet." I found his explanation marvelous and the simile to show me what life is. It seemed clear and comprehensive to me. However, I would like to know the height and diameter of this cone. My brother, the height of that cone is the height of the universe that we can call unlimited, and its diameter is equally unlimited. And what is the true base of this cone? What are we, what do we do, and where are we going? I thought, doubtfully. "In a few words I'll try to make myself understandable," said Dr. Jansel. "The basis of this cone can be summarized in 3 vital points. Birth, feeling and evolution. Each with its own significance. Birth, the most sacred of all things. Feeling, the evolutionary formation of being. Evolution, the reason for all created things. Thus, with birth we receive the synthesis of which is a divine particle and a spark of love. With feeling and understanding, we gain the greatness and the splendor of perfect creatures. With successive evolutionary cycles, we are led closer to God, our real goal. To summarize, we are the result of a divine act, birth. We cultivate the good and develop ourselves, feeling. Perennial travelers of the eternal journey, evolution." My attention was entirely focused on his philosophy, endeavoring to assimilate the meaning of his words, when Dr. Jansel, trying to console me, added, "Don't worry too much, go back to your world, which is generous and bright when you know how to lead your life. Don't embitter it with thoughts, making it dependent on what you can't get now. On the contrary, in the future you will have a new field of action because you will be able to see more clearly the raison d'etre of things and you will profitably dedicate yourself to spread the word about what you have seen and witnessed. If you can, write a booklet with the accounts of this trip. We promise to come back and we'll give you another trip in the future. So, you mean I'll be given the adventure of revisiting your world? As soon as possible, I hope," I said with unbridled enthusiasm. "Then we'll show you 3 more planets on the next trip, so that you can get a glimpse of the diversity of the constitution of the worlds, within the framework of the conception he alluded to. In my father's house there are many mansions," and went on to outline the conditions on the 3 planets. "The first planet, this one is in the antediluvian phase, in a kind of quaternary period of the earth, where its inhabitants pull the roots out of the ground with their bare hands and devour them with their impurities. The second planet we want to show you, you'll have the dissatisfaction of seeing its surface covered in 96% water. Its inhabitants know agriculture, but they struggle with a tremendous shortage of food. They sow in its inhospitable and inconsistent soil and the plants sprout, but when treated well produces a single fruit, but this take an interval corresponding to 8 months of your calendar. Thus, a bean plant produces a single bean, a pumpkin plant, a single pumpkin and an orange tree, a single orange. Evaluate, then, the struggle waged by these beings, who rely more on the aquatic element than on the substance of the soil itself. Although they are fast swimmers and expert divers, making the most expert swimmer on your planet envious, they are constantly forced to face the product of their environment, represented by monstrous and horrifying aquatic animals. Gigantic lizards and other large animals similar to the extinct Brontosaurus, Dimetrodons, sail-backed, and similar of the antediluvian era attack them. These animals, endowed with unrivaled ferocity, have the ability to draw their unfortunate victims into their jaws through suction. Unfortunate victims. These creatures are not far removed from the fish's organic constitution. In the liquid element they are strong and dexterous, but out of the water they are astonishingly fragile, supporting at most, an adult being, a load of 25 kilos. The third planet is very advanced and we can call it the light sphere. Maybe you'll get the chance to see it later through a special viewer. There, its inhabitants don't have such a dense body, they are, so to speak, semi-material. They live about 3,600 years of your time. They do not eat solid or liquid food, but absorb substances from the atmosphere. When they are breathing, they are already eating. Their lives take place under exceptional conditions and their work is limited exclusively to what concerns the spirit, developing such a powerful combination of mental strength that their will alone is enough to render us unconscious and immobile. Time and space mean little to them, because with the power of thought, they overpower the action of time, and all they need is the hint of an evil thought to materialize evil. From time to time, we are allowed to tune our video screens to this planet, which brings us unusual benefits, encourages progress, upliftment of feelings and, in general, the comforting knowledge that one day we will get there. But is it possible to have so much power with mere thought? Remember, my brother, what you have been clearly taught on your planet, faith removes mountains, faith is its purest expression. But I'm sure that when I try to tell Earth people about those worlds, they will retort, "You are talking nonsense." That was the gist of what I said to Dr. Jansel. I've already warned you that when this happens, just smile fraternally. Then, once again, I pestered Dr. Jansel, asking him about the fact that our humanity lives in a constant tangle of polemics and misunderstandings, asking him for clarification. Among other things, I remember that Dr. Jansel said to me, "If your humanity used the great intelligence with which its members are endowed, without vanity and selfishness in mutual collaboration, that is effective cooperation in the spirit of goodwill with the common aim of alleviating the sufferings of their fellow human beings, if they would endeavor to spread the scientific knowledge indispensable for collective progress to less fortunate peoples, they would have as a result real benefits which, within 30 years, would translate as if by magic into, A, the specter of war would disappear from the human collective consciousness, B, most current illnesses would be exterminated, elevating many people currently suffering into a true paradise, C, prevent young people from working until they reach adulthood, as the substitution of work for study should never be allowed, whether in industry or commerce, since this environment contributes to their moral formation."